Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 2015 Semrad Endowed Lecture in Non-Western Thought, presented annually by the Creighton Department of Philosophy. The lecture is meant to bring prominent scholars in non-Western thought to the campus to address students, faculty, staff, and the general public, and to open up a lively exchange of ideas that fosters intercultural understanding and dialogue. This year's speaker will be Jay Garfield, the Doris Silbert Professor in the Humanities and Professor of Philosophy at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and author of Sweet Reason, A Field Guide to Modern Logic, and most recently, Engaging Buddhism, Why It Matters to Philosophy. He'll speak on the topic, Just Saying, Untying Taoist Knots. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 24, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Richard White, Professor of Philosophy at Creighton University.
Dr. Jay Garfield has written extensively on the philosophy of Buddhism. He is also an expert on Indian philosophy. Tonight he will speak on Taoism, and he has published pioneering work that integrates Buddhist philosophical perspectives with recent work in analytical philosophy, logic, and cognitive science. Dr. Garfield graduated from Oberlin College and received his master's and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Pittsburgh. He is the editor-in-chief of the journal Sophia, and he is associate editor of the journal Cognitive Science. He's published a number of books, including, most recently, Engaging Buddhism and Why It Matters to Philosophy, and Moon Paths, Ethics in the Context of Conventional Truth, both published this year by Oxford University Press. Earlier books include works on modern logic, the Indian philosopher Nagarjuna, and cognitive science. Dr. Garfield is also the editor of numerous collections, including the Oxford Handbook of World Philosophy and Pointing at the Moon on Buddhism and Logical Analysis, also published by Oxford University Press. So we are very honored to have Professor Garfield as our 15th Semrad lecture. The title of his presentation tonight is Just Saying, Untying Taoist Knots. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Jay Garfield?
Thank you, Professor White, for a far too generous introduction. And thanks to the philosophy department here at Creighton for inviting me out. It's just been wonderful being here and meeting faculty and students. And of course, thanks Dan Semrad for the vision in endowing a regular lecture in non-Western philosophy. I think it is a gift beyond value to create this constant presence of non-Western philosophy in the university, because it's so easy, as we know from looking at universities all over the United States and the world, to pretend that philosophy is something only done in the West and to forget that there's a world outside of the West. So thank you very much for creating that opportunity. And it's a real honor to be here. This is a very distinguished series, and looking at those who have gone before me, it sort of makes me feel very small. So we'll see what we can do. So what I'm going to do today, let me tell you a bit about this project. The work that I'll be presenting, and this is, you're actually hearing it for the first time. Nobody but us has ever seen this stuff before. So it might turn out to be totally trashy, in which case you'll have to correct us and excuse us. But the work itself that I'll talk about tonight is joint work with my close colleague, Graham Priest, but it's part of a larger project, which is a book that four of us are writing. The other two are Yasuo Deguchi of Kyoto University and Bob Scharf at Berkeley, called Paradox. The book is actually going to be called What Can't Be Said, Paradox and Contradiction in East Asian Philosophy, and that's work supported by the John Templeton Foundation, to whom I am also very grateful. So this is a chapter of that book. In fact, it's the first chapter, and it's really rough and it's really new, so you're going to be seeing work in progress. While a lot of my work recently has been on the interface of Buddhist philosophy and Western philosophy, I've become more and more interested in the Taoist tradition as a result of looking at the way that Taoism inflects Chinese Buddhism, and Taoism in its own right turns out to be fascinating enough. So that's what we're going to do tonight. So there are four parts to the talk. The first is a very brief introduction. And then the second part is going to be on the Laozi. It's called Whereof One Cannot Speak, Laozi on the Tao. Then we're going to turn to a much longer part on the Zhuangzi, because the Zhuangzi is such a wonderful text that it's just so much fun to spend time with it. And finally, we'll try to draw some conclusions. That'll be short, too. So the bulk of things are going to be in part three. So let's talk now just about the Laozi. And we'll start by talking about the ineffability of the Tao. Now, the Laozi, also called the Tao Te Ching, is a collection of a text of uncertain ancestry, probably begun around the 5th century before the Common Era, but the text as we now have it seems to have stabilized around the 2nd or 3rd century before the Common Era. And we're going to be looking at the text itself in translation, of course, along with some passages from the commentary of the 2nd century BCE commentator on the Tao Te Ching, Wang Bi, who's a very perceptive commentator. And you find that a lot of the subsequent commentaries on the Tao Te Ching follow Wang Bi very closely. So let's begin at the very beginning of the Tao Te Ching. There are many, many translations of this text, by the way. In fact, it turns out to be the text that has been translated more than any other text in the world. And some of the text translations differ so much from each other that you wonder if they're even looking at the same text. But we're going to just pick one. And this is the one we're going to pick. Largely, this is a good scholarly translation that is associated closely with the Wang Bi translation, so we're going to use that. So it's not the most poetic, unfortunately. I like more poetic ones, but sometimes it makes sense to sacrifice poetry for lexical precision. Sometimes. But not always. Anyway, the first lines of the Tao Te Ching, very famous. The Tao that can be described in language is not the constant Tao. The name that can be given to it isn't the constant name. And I want to begin by just talking a bit about the word Tao. It's the easiest way to simply translate it into English is to say way. But a Tao can, the term Tao has all of the flexibility in classical Chinese that the word way has in English. So we can talk about a way of doing things. We can talk about the way the world is. We can talk about a way of life. We can talk about a way of speaking or a way of thinking. We can talk about the way that I chop carrots. Any of these are a Tao. A Tao can be when we talk about a way of speaking, a Tao can be a term or it can be a phrase or it can be a chapter. The whole Tao Te Ching is a Tao. Everything I speak tonight is a Tao. That sentence was a Tao. The way that I'm walking in front of you is my Tao of walking. So think of Tao as a very flexible term, and think of the Tao Te Ching as talking about it very flexibly. But one special use of the word Tao, the one that, of course, gets everybody excited, is when we talk about what we sometimes call the great Tao, the way of the world, the way the universe works, the big inframing of everything. And so you can think of small Taos as Taos within big Taos, just like a small phrase can be a Tao within a bigger Tao that's a discourse. Our ways of doing things, the way things are done at Creighton, the way things are done at Lincoln, the way things are done in Alabama, the way things are done in Massachusetts, are part of the way things are done in the United States, Taos that make bigger Taos. And that's together with the Tao of the way that bees pollinate flowers and the way that cows wander in fields as part of a bigger Tao, and we think about the way the astral bodies work in their orbits, that's part of a bigger Tao. Think about the way everything is, that's the great Tao. So we say the Tao that can be described in language, that's not the constant Tao. There's a lot of different ways to read this. We'll get there in a minute. Here's Wang Bi's commentary, though. Wang Bi tends to make things very precise. He says, the Tao that can be rendered in language, that is anything that you can talk about, anything that you can say, and the name can be given to it, they point to a thing. So when I talk about the Tao of me walking around, I'm pointing to me walking around in that way, or reproduce a form, neither of which is in its constancy. That's why it can't be rendered in language or given a name. So here Wang Bi is just saying, look, it's kind of like this. You start out with a single word, like the way I cut carrots, And then you imagine all the different things that are involved in carrot cutting. And the fact that when I started cutting carrots, I did it very badly, but now I do it really fast. And that one word, the way of cutting carrots, can't possibly encompass all of that. There's nothing I could say that would give you the totality of the experience of all of the ways that I can cut carrots. That's what Wangbi's worried about. But when we start talking now about the great Tao, things become a little bit richer indeed. So the Tao Te Ching, a little bit later in chapter 1, says, nameless, it's the origin of the myriad things. Named, it's the mother of the myriad things. And Wangbi helps us again with this. He says, anything that exists originates in nothingness. Now, pause on that one for a minute, right? So when we talk about individual things, tables, chairs, people, clickers, computer screens, and we ask where those came from. Well, they came from other things, and those things came from other things. Eventually, the stuff that we have, had to come from something. Where does it come from? Wangbi tells you it comes from nothing. Think about this if you want cosmologically. Think about the universe. Where does it come from? Modern physicists tell us it comes from a singularity, something that has no dimension at all, no things in it, no space, no time. That's nothing. So eventually, when you trace back all the somethings, you come to nothing. But another way to think about this is think about all the ways, all of the Taos. We can trace those back too. And we ask, where does my Tao of cutting carrots come from? It comes from my Tao of cooking. Where does my Tao of cooking come from? It comes from my kind of Tao of entertaining. Where does that come from? It comes from my Tao. Keep going back. Where do all the Taos come from? Where does the way that everything happens come from? If it comes from something, it has to be something greater or more transcendent than a way, and that's the nothing. So then he says, look, when it's still nameless, when we get back to the singularity, back to the way everything is, it's the origin of things. It's only once it starts being particularized, once it starts manifesting in particular things, in tables, chairs, carrots, and knives, that we end up with things that we can name. That's the mystery beyond mystery, how we get from nothing to something. Wangbi's not going to go there, and we don't need to go there either, because that's not what we're worried about right now. What we're worried about is this issue of ineffability. In chapter 25, the Tao Te Ching tells us something amorphous and complete before heaven and earth, immaterial, it stands unchanged, right? Again, this kind of arche beyond discourse, this way that things are that makes all possible things possible. And so Wangbi's gloss is what I care about this. He says names are used to determine forms. So when I say the clicker, I mean this thing. When I say the chair, I mean that thing. When I say Professor White, I mean that thing. Names determine particular things. That's what they do. But the Tao isn't a particular thing. It's the way all things are. For those of you who enjoy wallowing in Heidegger, think about the difference between beings and being. Being isn't one more being among beings. It's the way that things get to be. Similarly, the Tao isn't one more thing among things. It's the way things get to exist. So it's prior to ontology. It's prior to entities. And so he says, we can't make any such determination there. So we don't even know what to call it. We don't even know what its name is. Any bit of language would fail to encompass what that thing is. And one last passage from Wangbi, and then we're going to actually do a little philosophy. He says, the way things come into existence and the way that efficacy comes about is things arise from the formless, from this kind of primordial Tao. And efficacy emanates from the nameless. The formless and the nameless, something we can't even describe, something beyond discourse, is the necessary condition of the possibility of discourse. Whatever makes discourse possible can't just be more discourse. It has to be something non-discursive, something non-represented. If it had form, it would have to be distinguished from other things. But we can't distinguish the Tao from other things. It's everything. So, why is the Tao ineffable? That's what we really care about. By the way, I just want to remind you of this. What I'm not trying to convince you of is that everything in the Tao Te Ching is right. I'm not trying to convince you that there is this great Tao that we have to be thinking about. What I'm trying to convince you of is that the idea that paradox and contradiction are not necessarily bad things is built right into this perspective, and that we can't understand Taoist philosophy without a commitment to the importance and the assertability of paradoxes. And so we're beginning with a paradox in the Tao Te Ching. It's a paradox of ineffability. The paradoxes will get even more interesting when we hit the Zhuangzi. And then I promise you, I'm going to unsettle you a little bit. If you don't want to be unsettled, leave the room. That was a trigger warning. okay, so names, as Wang Bi and the Tao Te Ching point out, are names for things. That's what they are. When we've got a noun, it refers to a kind of a thing. But the Tao is the condition of the possibility of things. It's not a thing, so it can't have a name. It's prior to all of that. Moreover, Wang Bi said, names draw distinctions. There's a difference between me and Professor White, and that's why we've got different names. But there are no distinctions in the Tao. The Tao is just this, the condition of the possibility of drawing distinctions. And finally, and I think this is really important, names are things. They might be abstract things, they might be linguistic things, but they're things. And the Tao exists prior to all things. The Tao is ontologically prior to things, so it's ontologically prior to names. So if we're just thinking about the Tao, we can't be thinking about any name for the Tao. So the Tao has to be ineffable. But there's a rub, a really big rub. The Tao's ineffable, but the Lao Tzu and we, over the last few minutes, have been saying a lot about it. One of the things we've said about it is that it's ineffable, right? So we've said it's totally undescribable, and saying that it's undescribable is a great way of describing it. So we find ourselves in a paradox of effability and ineffability. We say that we can't eff it, but the only way that we can say that we can't eff it is to eff it. indeed, all of that great discussion of Wang Bi explaining why you can't say anything about the Tao was saying all of these reasons that you can't say anything about the Tao, and that involves saying quite a lot about the Tao. So the moment you say anything's ineffable, you end up in these terrible paradoxes. Now, this isn't the first time that's happened, right? We've got lots of paradoxes of ineffability in the history of the Western tradition, but this is one in the history of the Taoist tradition. And the thing that I want you to keep noticing here is nobody says, oh my God, we've hit a paradox, there's a contradiction, something's gone wrong. Rather, Wang Bi simply says, yes, it's ineffable, you can't say anything about it. Now let me tell you about it and why you can't do that. There's a certain comfort with paradox that I admire. So now we're going to go to the third part, the longest part of the talk, which I call just saying. And this is all about the Zhuangzi. And here's an interesting fact about the Zhuangzi, which again is a book that seems to coalesce around the second to the first century before the Common Era. There's a lot of controversy about how much of it was written by a single person. Obviously not all of it was. Most scholars think that about five or six chapters called the inner chapters were written by the same guy. We can call him Zhuang, or Zhuangzi. And we'll be looking at one of those inner chapters, my favorite inner chapter, everybody's favorite inner chapter, the second chapter, which is called about the equality of things, about the non-difference between things. I think here's the most fascinating thing about the Zhuangzi. I don't know a philosopher who has read the Zhuangzi and who would not say, it's my favorite book in philosophy ever. It's so cool. And if you haven't read the Zhuangzi, then don't waste another day. Pick up a good copy of the Zhuangzi tomorrow and start reading. It is so much fun, you can't believe it. It's very perplexing, it's very difficult to figure out what's going on sometimes, but it's always rewarding. Again, lots of good translations. Probably the most scholarly translation available now is the one by Brooke Zipperin, and that's a very good translation. But if you want pure poetry, read the old Angus Graham translation, which is quite lovely. Those in the audience who are sinologists will undoubtedly disagree with me about both of those things, but that's okay. I've got the microphone. So first, here's the passage that's going to get us going. It's a passage that you're going to look at first and you're going to say, it's totally weird, that doesn't make any sense. And I promise you by the end it's going to make a lot of sense and it's going to be fascinating. So here, I'm going to give you three different translations of it so you can get a feel for some of the triangulation we have to do to understand these texts if you don't read classical Chinese. And then we're going to focus on one of them. So this is from Angus Graham. And he says, rather than use the meaning to show that the meaning is not the meaning, use what's not the meaning. Rather than use a horse to show that a horse is not a horse, use what's not a horse. Heaven and earth are one meaning. The myriad things are the one horse. Totally clear, right? Absolutely. So now we can just move on. Here's a different translation from Brooke Zipperin. He says, to use this finger to show how a finger is not a finger is no match for using not this finger to show that a finger is not a finger. To use this horse to show that a horse is not a horse is no match for using not this horse to show that a horse is not a horse. Heaven and earth are one finger. All things are one horse. Finger, meaning. Now I'm going to give you the translation that I find most useful, but it's all useful to keep all of these in mind. This one's by Kjellberg. He says, making a point to show that a point is not a point is not as good as making a non-point to show that a point is not a point. Using a horse to show that a horse is not a horse is not as good as using a non-horse to show that a horse is not a horse. Heaven and earth are one point. The 10,000 things are one horse. Now, it's still not totally clear. I agree. We're going to get there, though. But here's one thing I want you to see, that this word that's being translated is point, finger, meaning. It's one character, zhi, which can mean finger, point, or horse. But, you know, you think about that. It can mean the root meaning is finger. That's the kind of original meaning. But it can also mean to use that finger to point to something. It can also mean the thing that you've pointed out or a point that you've just made, right? Same as the word in English. So don't get, you know, troubled by fingers, points, and meanings. Point's a pretty good general word, and it's one of the reasons that I like the Kjellberg here. So we're going to stick with that one. It's still not totally transparent, is it? If I were to give you a quick quiz, explain the argument, it's a little puzzling, right? Okay, our task is to make it clear. If we succeed, you're going to be impressed, right? We're going to do that. Okay. So first of all, what part of what makes this text so hard is that it's totally metonymic. The words finger and horse are both metonyms for stuff that none of us read. So now we're going to kind of reveal the metonyms, the things that are being used here. And it all has to do with a debate between a younger contemporary of Zhuangzi, who is named Gongsun Long. And Gongsun Long was a philosopher in what's sometimes called the school of names. I like to call it the logicist school. These are a bunch of logicians and philosophers of language hanging around in China at the time that the Tao Te Ching is being written. And Zhuangzi is very much an opponent of this school. But he's worried about Gongsun Long. And so now, first of all, we get the horse. There's a very famous argument, very famous little debate. We're not going to go through it in detail. It's A, not worth it because it's really stupid, and B, it would take a lot of time. But it's going to give you an idea of what Zhuangzi is talking about. So Gongsun Long asks the question, can it be that a white horse is not a horse? It's one of the first things you learn when you start learning logic, right? And so one party to the debate says, it can. Wow. And the objector says, how? And here's why. Well, the word horse is that by means of which one names the shape. And white names the color. What names the color is not what names the shape. So a white horse isn't a horse. A white horse is a horse, a shape plus a color. The other one's just... This is a bad argument, right? It's a really dumb argument. If you start arguing this way, I'd lose all respect for you. Then the objector says, but wait, if there are white horses, you can't say there's no horses. So how can you say a white horse isn't a horse? And it goes on. And it goes on for pages. And it does not get any better, okay? None of it's interesting. It's only interesting that people took this seriously at some point. But here's the point, or the horse. Let's first go to a second one, and then we'll get there. This is the other Gongsun Long passage that Zhuangzi is worried about. He says, all things are capable of being pointed out, and you could also translate that as fingered, like finger somebody, point them out. But pointing out can never be pointed out. This is actually a much deeper point. Those of you who have studied classical Indian philosophy and have read the grammarian Bhartahari will recognize this as a version of Bhartahari's paradox. The idea that if you think about meaning in terms of a relation between terms and things, then think now about the word meaning. That's got to be a relation between the word meaning and a relation between terms and things, but then it would have to be part of the relation it names, and so it can't. So the word meaning has to be meaningless, but if the word meaning is meaningless, nothing means anything. This was Bhartahari's argument in 3rd century BCE India, and Gongsun Long has hit on the same idea. I can point to Professor White, I can point to, what's your name? I can point to Raymond, and I can point to myself, and I can point to the chair. But now if you say, okay, now point at pointing, it's really hard, right? And that's what Gongsun Long has in mind. So if you translate that up to meaning, you see that you get this interesting question. So the metonyms. A horse in that initial passage, when we say better to use a non-horse to show that a horse is not a horse, is just a metonym for an argument. That's all it means. We say a horse, he's not talking about horses. He's talking about arguments, because anybody who reads this text in classical China knows all about the stupid Gongsun Long passage. And a finger, right, is a point. It's just any old point, okay? So he's talking about points you might make. So here's a way to translate the last part of that passage. We can say better to use a non-argument than an argument to show that no argument can be probative. And now all of your Sextus Empiricus bells are going off, right? As they should be. Better to say something meaningless than something meaningful if you want to show that words have no meaning, which is, to quote Led Zeppelin, which is what Gongsun Long has in mind, right? That in some sense words can't be meaningful. And so now we're going to see that passage is a double reply to Gongsun Long in the end. So those are the metonyms. But now we need to give the background in order to understand that. And we're going to do that by exploring a few more passages in the second chapter of the Tao Te Ching. Because partly what I'm trying to do is to give a reading of that original passage and to show you the depth and complexity of its paradoxes by triangulating it with a lot of other passages in the text. It's not a text that you can read sentence by sentence. You read it all, then you figure out how it gets put together. So this is another very famous passage in the second chapter. Zhuangzi says, do you understand? You hear the piping of men, the sounds we make, I'm piping right now, but not yet the piping of the earth. You hear the piping of the earth, but not the piping of heaven. So the piping of the earth means just the sounds of these hollows, you know, the wind and, you know, stones and water running through waterfalls and things like that. The piping of men would just be the sound of bamboo pan pipes, things that we make with pipes, but also bamboo pan pipes are a metaphor for this pipe here, wind pipes. What then is the piping of heaven? What does it all mean, right? What does it all mean? We ask that question from time to time in philosophy. So what does this or not mean? So here's the idea that Zhuangzi has in this particular passage. We pipe, we make noises, we make stuff. Nature pipes, the wind blows, water falls off waterfalls, rocks tumble down mountains. The universe pipes, we could think about the, you know, the sounds of the heavenly spheres if you want to get suitably poetic and suitably metaphorical. But we take our own piping, what we do as human beings when we talk, to be really special. It's not like the barking of dogs. It's not like the sound of waters and waterfalls. It's not like the sound of the wind. We think that when we're making the noises that we make naturally, that I'm making right now, that they're really special, that they're meaningful. And Zhuangzi asks us in this passage, and you have to get very careful about the dialectical context here. He's not saying, okay, so it's just like this, guys. The sounds we make are just like the sounds of barking dogs and lowing cattle and blowing winds. Nothing we say means anything. He's not saying that. That'd be a crazy thing to say, in fact, right? Gongsun Long invites you to that conclusion by arguing that the word meaning is meaningless. But Zhuangzi is not going there, but he is doing this. He asks you in this passage to just consider the possibility that our piping is one more species of making noise in the same way that rocks and dogs and cattle do. Just consider the possibility. And what you're going to see is that something really magical happens when you start considering the possibility. Once it's a possibility, it's startlingly hard to refute. So I tell you, guess what? All this noise that I'm making, it's just noise. It doesn't mean anything. And by the way, all the noise that you might even make in reply, it's just noise. It doesn't mean anything. And you say, no, 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 that can't be. So how are you going to refute it? Well, here's the obvious way to refute it, if you wanted to try to do that. You'd say, Zhuangzi, you ignorant pig, right? You've got a problem, right? Because you've either got to mean something by those words when you say that my words aren't meaningless or not. And if you don't mean anything, I've got no reason to believe you. You're just barking like a dog. But if you do mean something when you say that there's no meaning, then you've undermined your own position. So Zhuangzi, checkmate. That's the easy way to do it, right? Not so fast. It doesn't work. So suppose I'm Zhuangzi and you say that. Here's what I say. Nice noises there. Those were cool noises. I made some nice noises too. End of story. Who cares? Notice that in order for your reply to actually convince me, you've got to presuppose that it means something. And if you've presupposed that, you've presupposed exactly what was at issue. You've begged the question. So Zhuangzi's point is that once you put this on the table, once you raise the question at all, then you've got a hypothesis that you can't refute without begging the question. That is, what you've done, William James has a nice term for this in his Varieties of Religious Experience, you've got this idea that you've created an open question, a live option. And once the option is live, that language is meaningless, you've got a problem. Zhuangzi thinks that that option, and it's an option we can set up just by raising the question, raises a very deep paradox. That is, it's an epistemological paradox. We can never know that what we say or think is meaningful, but we can also know it. So he's going to demonstrate a very deep contradiction. Zhuangzi is important because he really fights for the paradoxical contradictions, and he fights for them in a way that's actually revealing. So again, I just want to point out, he's not arguing that our language is meaningless. He's saying, raise the question with me, and I'm going to show you a problem. The problem arises because it's a live option, and the paradox is going to not be a paradox about meaning, but a paradox about knowledge. So how do we do this? Here's the argument that we cannot know that our words are meaningful. Well, it's really easy. To know that what we say or think is meaningful is to believe it with some reason, to believe it with justification. But to accept the justification, any reasons for believing that it's meaningful, we'd have to assume that that justification is meaningful. So we'd already have to have begged the question. On the other hand, you might just say, well, I'm just not going to have any justification. I'm just going to assert it. I'm just going to say what I'm doing is meaningful. But if we do that, again, we manage to beg the question. We can't know that just by saying it. So the conclusion is we can't know that our language is meaningful. However, there's a second argument. We just came to know that we can't know that our language is meaningful. How did we come to know that? We came to know that through an argument. The only way that we could have known it through the argument was if the argument is meaningful. So even if that argument convinced us that we can't know that our language is meaningful, it has to also convince us at the same time that we can know that our language is meaningful because we were convinced by the argument. So we have an argument that we do know that our language and thought is meaningful as well. And so the conclusion Zhuangzi can draw just from raising the piping question is that we can both know and cannot know that our language is meaningful. And that's a deep paradox. Part of the genius of Zhuangzi is seeing that you start with this kind of Gongsun Long thing about meaning, and you can raise it to this epistemic register and get this very profound paradox. Second piece of background as we go to understand the horse and the finger, which is where we're going. I won't read all of this here, but what you'll see is that as you read it, you've got a version of Sextus Empiricus' problem of the criterion. So Sextus Empiricus sets it up this way. He says, how can we know that you can convince people that you should be convinced by arguments, say by deductive arguments, syllogistic arguments? Well, if you're going to get convinced that syllogistic arguments should convince you of anything, you should either be able to do that by a demonstrative syllogistic argument or a non-demonstrative argument. But if you're already worried that syllogistic arguments aren't probative, then you can't convince yourself of that by a syllogistic argument. So maybe you would use a non-demonstrative argument, an inductive argument. But for the inductive argument to convince you that syllogistic arguments are good, you'd also need the premise that inductive arguments can convince you that things are true. But that's how it turns it into a deductive argument, in which case you're back in the soup again. So what Zhuangzi does is just do this in a slightly different register. He does it not in thinking of an argument as doing the convincing, but a referee is doing it. So, you know, I end up in a disagreement with you, we're fighting about something, and you say, okay, we need to resolve this, right? And so you have a choice. You can either, I say, okay, I know somebody who agrees with me. She'll help resolve the argument. You don't agree. You won't accept her. And you say, and I'm not going to accept that person. So then we say, okay, let's find somebody who doesn't know anything about this. Well, how is that person going to resolve anything at all, right? Or if they don't agree with either of us in the first place, why should either of us trust them, right? We don't think they know anything. So it's just the problem of the criterion done instead of a background argument in terms of a judge. So it's a kind of independent discovery of that problem. Keep that one in your mind, because that's going to be involved in the point that's not a point, and the horse that's not a horse. But before we do that, we're going to go to what I think is probably the most famous passage of all in chapter 2 of the Zhuangzi, the butterfly passage. If anybody knows one passage of Zhuangzi, they know this one. But I'll bet they can't figure out what the hell it's supposed to mean. So I'm going to read it with you. Once Zhuangzi dreamt he was a butterfly, fluttering about joyfully, just as a butterfly would. He followed his whims exactly as he liked, and he knew nothing about Zhuangzi. Suddenly he awoke, and there he was, the startled Zhuangzi in the flesh. He didn't know if Zhou had been dreaming he was a butterfly, or if a butterfly was now dreaming it was Zhou. Surely Zhou and a butterfly count as two distinct entities. Such is what we call the transformation of things, or the transformation of one thing into another. Now, this is, a very often misread passage. People see it as some kind of an ancestor of Descartes' dream argument, and that it's somehow the conclusion supposed to be, damn, I can't figure out whether I'm a butterfly or not, I can't know anything at all. But notice Zhuangzi never does anything like that with it. And the important thing to figure out in this, if you're going to make any sense of this, you've got to make sense of that last sentence. Such is what we call the transformation of things, the transformation of one thing into another. If your account doesn't make that the central point, then you probably haven't understood the text. That's a good kind of check on reading this. The other thing to keep in mind when you read this is that it occurs in this chapter that's called On the Equality of Things, okay? On the Non-Difference Between Things. So it's somehow about that as well. So, what do we do about the butterfly? Let's think about the butterfly. We're going to think about it in terms of waking up, okay? So don't go to sleep now. You'll miss the good part. The thing is that, like a lot of Zhuangzi's arguments in the inner chapters, it turns out to be a live option argument. Zhuangzi loves live option arguments, and that's a good key to reading the text. Normally, you know, at least I think, I'm sure that's true here. Well, I'm not sure. Maybe Nebraska's as different as I think. But like being a butterfly is not a live option for us. That is, I don't think that many of us begin the day saying, all right, now I've got to decide what I am. Centipede? Cow? Butterfly? Human being? I need to figure out which one I am. If you start your day like this, call your doctor. and it's not because we've also begun our day by saying, okay, good, I've ticked it all off. I've proven I'm not a horse. I've proven I'm not a centipede. I've proven I'm not a butterfly. By elimination, I must be a human being, right? It's not like we've done that at all, okay? It just doesn't turn out that way. And I honestly believe, though I've never checked, that for most butterflies, being a human philosopher isn't one of the things they kind of tick off before they go to the next flower. Because human philosophers can't land on flowers, but butterflies can. And it's not like they say, okay, I've got to figure out all the things I'm not, figure out what I am to see whether I can flit to the flower. Butterflies don't do that, I think. But it's that liminal moment, that moment when you wake up. You're not quite awake. The alarm clock still doesn't even make any sense. You've been dreaming you're a butterfly. Now you're awake. At that very moment, you're kind of not sure. Am I a butterfly? Am I a human being? What's going on? Now, suppose you're at that moment and your mom comes into the room, right? Time for school! And at that moment, is it your mom says, oh my God, there it is again. He can't figure out whether he's a human being or a butterfly. This happens all the time. I'm going to give you an argument. And I'm going to convince you that you're a human being, right? And she starts, look, you've got hands and feet, and you've got hair, and you're bigger than any butterfly, and you're understanding English, and butterflies can't do that, right? So you've got to be a butterfly. Are you convinced by your mom when she does that? No. Because if you think you might be a butterfly dreaming you're a person, if you really think that, then you think now you're a butterfly dreaming you're a person with an annoying mother, right? That's what you think, right? So if it's really a live option that you're a butterfly, nothing she says is going to convince you, right? That's how it is. Try it sometime. So no argument can. And this is actually important, right? Because Zhuangzi is really talking about the limits of arguments. If you really believe that you might be a butterfly, nothing I can say is going to help you, right? That's when you go for medication. So another way to put this, right, what makes us sure that we're philosophers or human beings is not an argument, but it's our just basic mode of being. It's the fact that we just enact the life of human beings. It's not more than that. That's where the spade is turned. You don't, if somebody says, gee, I can't figure out what I am, from a human being, a horse, or whatever, that person isn't philosophically confused. That person is nuts, right? That's what that person is. Because ordinarily, simply enacting that kind of life, that big a Tao, is enough for us to understand ourselves as human beings. Our Tao isn't something that we justify, the way we lead our lives as human beings. It's something that we do. Just like the Tao of being a butterfly isn't something a butterfly justifies to itself. It just does it. If you were to really change into a butterfly, or say a cockroach, to choose another metamorphosis, that wouldn't simply be a kind of slight change, like deciding I'm going to wear red today instead of blue. That would be a transformation of things. Okay, that's not simply something you can justify. Somebody might say, gee, why are you wearing red today? Oh, I think I look good in red. Actually, no, you don't. Put the blue back on, right? You're going to give an argument for making or not making a small change. Should I study philosophy or should I study mathematics? Math's really hard. Do philosophy. Okay, I'll do philosophy. There's all kinds of things you can give arguments for. But fundamental transformation in your mode of being, that's not something you do by argument. That's really deep transformation. And that's what that line means at the end. So another way to put this is justification and argument is something that happens within a Tao, within the Tao of being a human being, within the Tao of being a language user and a reasoner. We don't step outside of our Tao, outside of our way of being, to justify our way of being. There is no place outside of your way of being. You can't say, for a moment, I'm going to suspend being a human being and see if I can find any good reasons to keep being one. You don't get to do that. You just don't get to do that. So what's the point, or what's the horse? Now we can finally have enough to come back to the point and the horse. So here's the passage again. Making a point to show that a point is not a point is not as good as making a non-point to show that a point is not a point. Using a horse to show that a horse isn't a horse isn't as good as using a non-horse to show that a horse is not a horse. Heaven and earth are one great point. 10,000 things are one damned horse. First, the point. Gongsun Long, remember, establishes the point that we can't make a point by arguing for it, and so he asserts that, right? He argues that we can't make a point. And so by saying you can't make a point, he falsifies his own conclusion. So it would seem then that the only way to show that what looks like a point isn't a point can't be to make a point. What Gongsun Long should be doing is making a non-point to show that. That's the only way he could do that without undermining himself. That's what Zhuangzi is saying here. Because you want to argue that there's no meaning. The only way you can do that is to do something meaningless. Because if you do something meaningful, you will have undermined yourself. The problem is that if meaningful assertion is really impossible, the only way you can do that is to do something, to say that, is to do something meaningless. But suppose you did that. So I do something meaningless. To show that there's no meaning. But if I succeeded, then whatever I did would be to make a point. And so one way to look at this is heaven and earth are one great point. You can't get outside of discourse to say something about discourse, whether it's to say that it's possible or impossible. The world of discourse and meaning isn't something you can stand out of and question. It's something that you simply find yourself totally immersed in. So Zhuangzi applies that first paradox, the paradox of meaning, against Gongsun Long. If you want to show we can't say anything, you can't do it by saying that. You'd have to do it by something other than saying. And if you succeeded, you'd be just saying, because it would be just saying it in a different way. And so you couldn't show it that way either. On the other hand, to show you can't say stuff without saying anything is either to say nothing at all, which isn't very useful, or to falsify your own claims by saying that. So, conclusion, you can neither say nor not say that you can't say stuff. On the other hand, for all we know, you can't say anything. But we can't say that either. That's actually a very, very deep paradox of expressibility, much deeper than the one Gongsun Long starts with. This is what Zhuangzi does to you. He starts with a paradox that looks like it might be a little puzzling, and he ends up sticking you head first down in deep contradiction. Now the horse. Zhuangzi has argued in that discussion of the criterion that arguments can't settle anything. How's he done that? He's argued for that point. He's argued that arguments can't establish anything. This is kind of dangerous. So that argument can't establish that arguments can't establish anything, because no argument can do that. So no horse, right, horse is just an argument now, can establish that a horse is not a horse. So it's better to use a non-horse, that is a non-argument, to establish this conclusion. Because if you try to do it with an argument, you've just undermined everything that you're doing. But suppose you did, so now I'm going to use a non-argument. Whatever that non-argument manages to be, whatever you do, if it establishes the conclusion that arguments can't prove anything, then by establishing it, it's just become another argument. Every damn thing is one more horse. You try to do it without an argument, and what you've done has become an argument. So just as you can't step out of the domain of discourse to make claims about discourse, you can't step out of the domain of arguments to establish that arguments are probative, or even to argue that they're not. And that's a consequence of having successfully done so. So the predicament. Now Zhuangzi has really dug us into a hole. We're stuck as human beings in a discursive and dialectical domain. That is, we talk, we argue, we think, and we reason. We can't vindicate that domain. We can't give reasons to think that giving reasons is a good idea. We can't argue that arguments are useful things. We can't use language to justify the claim that language is meaningful, or even that it's meaningless. It just all sounds like mindless piping. It's like it can't do anything. But nonetheless, it does convince us of stuff. Not only can't we know whether we can't say anything, but we can't even argue that we can't know that. Nor can we refrain from arguing. We speak and can't know whether it's all nonsense. We reason and we can't know whether it makes any sense. It's that deep sense. Didn't I promise you it would be unsettling? Right? The trigger warning was there. Zhuangzi wants to put you totally at sea. You think that if anything can save you, it's reason. If you can rely on anything, it's meaning. And Zhuangzi says you've got no reason to believe any of that, nor do you have any way to convince yourself that what you think is meaningful is. And what we're going to do now, we're going to get out of the predicament, okay? We've got into the predicament. We're going to get out of it. And we're going to do it by carving oxen, which is always a good way to get out of any predicament, I've found. Another great passage from chapter 2, often called the Cook Ding passage, because in some translations we translate the name Ding. So this cook is carving up an ox for King Hui of Liang. Wherever his hand smacked it, wherever, this is the zipper in translation, by the way, wherever his shoulder leaned into it, wherever his foot braced it, wherever his knee pressed it, the thwacking tones of flesh falling from bone would echo. The knife would whiz through with resonant thwangs, each stroke ringing out the perfect note. A tune, I don't know how you do this, I've never been able to do this, a tune to the dance of the mulberry grove or the Jingshou chorus of the ancient sage kings. The king just said, wow, this is just so cool that skill can reach to such heights. And I'm going to read you a little bit more of this, which I love. This is the answer of the butcher. He says, he put down his knife and he said, you know, what I love is the Tao, something that advances beyond mere skill. It's a lot better than just carving oxen. When I first started cutting up oxen, all I looked at for 3 years, all I could see were oxen. And still I was unable to see that all there was to see in an ox. But now I encounter it with the spirit rather than scrutinizing it with my eyes. My understanding consciousness, beholden to its specific purpose, comes to a halt. The promptings of the spirit begin to flow. I depend on heaven's unwrought perforations to strike in the larger gaps. With the larger hollows, I go by how they already are, playing them as they lay. So my knife never has to cut through the knotted tendons where the warp hits the woof, much less the joints of bones. Where there's infinite space, an infinitely thin knife can go easily. That's good to know, by the way. A good cook changes his blade once a year. He slices. An ordinary cook changes his blade once a month. He hacks. I've been using this same blade for 19 years, cutting up thousands of oxen, and it's still as sharp as the day it came off the whetstone. For the joints have spaces within them, and the very edge of the blade has no thickness at all. When what has no thickness enters empty space, it's vast and open with more than enough room for the play of the blade. That's why my knife is still as sharp as if it had come off the whetstone after 19 years. Now, most people stop reading here. We're not going to stop reading here. We're going to get to the important part. Nonetheless, whenever I come to a clustered tangle, realizing that it's difficult to do anything about it. I instead restrain myself as if terrified until my seeing comes to a complete halt. My activity slows and the blade moves ever so slightly. Then all at once I find the ox already dismembered at my feet like clumps of soil scattered on the ground. I retract the blade and stand there gazing at my work arrayed around me, dawdling over it with satisfaction. Then I wipe off the blade and put it away. How does this help? How does this help us get out of the predicament? Well, let's read. It's easy, and here's how most people who comment on this comment on it, to focus on the spontaneity that Cook Ding shows in carving the ox. He's not thinking about what to do. He's just kind of like in the flow of ox carving, thwacking and thwanging and singing about mulberry groves. And that's actually really important. But the most important passage, the one that people miss, is the one when he discusses what he does when he hits those thickets and tangles, the hard parts. What does he do there? His activity slows. He starts thinking, and he deliberates about what to do. So that point, so this whole argument, this whole discussion, the whole parable, is not about the idea that calculative thought is pointless, which is how most people read it. They say, what this shows is just go with the flow, stop thinking, lead your life like Butcher Ding carving oxen, and everything will be really cool. You'll just have your infinitely thin blade will go through the great spaces of existence, and all will be well. That actually doesn't work so well. It's not about that, but rather about the place of such thought and the necessity. What makes him such a good butcher isn't that he can do all this stuff, you know, spontaneously without thinking. It's that he knows when to think and when not to think. And he knows what to think when it's time to think. So reason might be not what the very thing that guides our still life. It's not the big category. It's not the whole way of being that we have. That would be really boring, right? That is, as I like to put it here, it's not the structure of our mode of Dasein, our mode of being. But it's important that we know how to think when we have to stop and when things break down. It's one thing to calculate every moment of your life. Where should I put my foot next? What position should my fingers be in? What word should I speak? It would be terrible, right? But it's another thing, and just as bad, not to know when to think and how to think when it's time to think. So, Zhuangzi in Butcher Ding, and again, remember the title of the whole chapter, The Equality of Things, isn't distinguishing spontaneous from calculative modes of being. That wouldn't be the equality of things. That would be to say, be spontaneous, don't be calculative. That's exactly what Zhuangzi never does, right? Zhuangzi always tries to show you why things are the same. What he's trying to do instead is to show you that being calculative is one of the things we can do spontaneously. Thinking is something you can do spontaneously, and when it's time to think, you'd better think. How does this help? Well, we can now ask the question. Remember, we're trying to get out of this predicament. Zhuangzi stuck us knee-deep in it, right? How do we know how what makes reason work and when our language is significant? Zhuangzi is pointing out that it's not because reason or language can tell us that. Reason can't justify reason. Using language can't justify using language. That's the wrong way to go about it. Nor is it because something else could provide that transcendental ground. That is, the whole world is one horse. The whole world is one point. We couldn't sort of whistle in order to understand why language is meaningful and stamp our feet to understand why arguments work. It's just the fact. Here's what it is. It's the way we pipe, the way we organize our lives, the way we handle our knots and tangles. That's the way that humans live. That's not a foundation of the way we live. It's not a way beyond ways that we could somehow appeal to. It's just the way that we live. Nothing justifies us in that. Justification happens once we already have a way to live. So we're going to finish with one final passage from chapter 2 of the Zhuangzi, the uncarved block, that's going to help us sort this out finally. Huizi says to Zhuangzi, I've got this huge tree that people call the stink tree. The trunk is swollen and gnarled, impossible to align with any level or ruler. The branches are twisted and bent. They're impossible to align to any T-square. Even if it were growing right in the road, a carpenter wouldn't give it a second glance. And your words, Zhuangzi, are similarly big but useless, which is why they're rejected by everybody who hears them. Nobody's going to listen to you, because all you're doing is giving us these parables and these stories and these goofy paradoxical arguments. Nobody's going to listen to you, Zhuangzi. Zhuangzi said, so, you've got this big tree, and you worry it's useless. why not plant it near your house? Then you could loaf and wander there, doing lots of nothing at its side. You could take a nap. It'll never be cut down by an axe or a saw, because you've said carpenters aren't interested in it. Nothing will harm it. Since it can't be used, what could entrap or afflict it? And so I want to come back to Huizi, right? Huizi says, your words are similarly big but useless, which is why they're rejected. We have to figure out what the analogy is here. So I'm going to carve that block a little bit with you. The analogy here is not the analogy that a lot of commentators see. A lot of commentators say, oh, this is just about the Taoist way of life. You should live like an uncarved block. You should, because if you live like an uncarved block or a stink tree, nobody's going to cut you down. Nobody's going to make use of you. Be as useless as you can. This is advice I often give to junior colleagues, actually. Be as useless as you can, and you'll never be made department chairman, right? Yeah, you see? Good advice. So it's like, lead this life as a gnarled tree. But that's not what it means. Because Huizi's analogy wasn't between the tree and Taoist way of life. It was between the tree and Zhuangzi's arguments. He didn't say, lead your life like a tree. He said, your arguments are like a tree, like the stink tree. Zhuangzi's arguments can't be measured by a philosopher's rule or a T-square. That is, there's no independent standard beyond arguments we can use to believe them. So they should be rejected by everybody who hears them, because you've got no reason to believe any of these arguments. And of course, the reason they should be rejected is because they are such compelling arguments for their own uselessness that we can't help but be compelled by them. And they tell us to reject them, so you should reject them. But of course, in rejecting them, what are you doing? You're accepting them. So the conclusion is this. Both the Laozi and the Zhuangzi are committed to dialetheism. They're committed to true contradictions. The Laozi and Wang Bi's commentary committed to the idea that the Tao is ineffable and that we can say that and that we can say it meaningfully. The Zhuangzi is committed to the idea that we can use arguments to prove things and that arguments are completely impotent, that we cannot know whether our language is meaningful and that we can know that our language is meaningful. Neither of these texts backs off from them. Neither of them says, oh my God, I've hit a contradiction. There must be a problem. I've got to go back and make all of this consistent. And in each case, the contradictions aren't accidents. They're not things that just kind of we discover and they're interesting puzzles. They reflect deep Taoist commitments. They reflect the commitment to the idea that the lives we live are and must remain ultimately ungrounded. And it's that ungroundedness that grounds them. It's the ungroundedness that makes it possible to live. And so the big insight that I really hope you take away from this kind of introduction to Taoist philosophy is that reality itself might be really contradictory. So when somebody tells you you need a logic that eschews contradictions, tell them that the Tao that can be spoken can't possibly be a constant Tao. And I want to thank, again, the John Templeton Foundation and the Yale NUS College and all these people who have supported this work, and to once again thank Creighton University for giving me an opportunity to share this with you for its very first time. And I look forward to hearing what's wrong with it. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the 2015 Semrad Endowed Lecture in Non-Western Thought, presented annually by the Creighton Department of Philosophy. This year's speaker was Jay Garfield, the Doris Silbert Professor in the Humanities and Professor of Philosophy at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and author of Sweet Reason, A Field Guide to Modern Logic, and most recently, Engaging Buddhism, Why It Matters to Philosophy. He spoke on the topic, Just Saying, Untying Taoist Knots. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 24, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.